Hello, this is Tom Haley, host of Kentucky Voices and Views, a podcast about interesting people, places, and activities around Kentucky. This episode features a conversation with Jerry Young. I met Jerry in 1979 when I attended my first Toastmasters meeting. He has been my friend for 33 years. He has also been an inspiration and mentor to me and to many other people. Jerry lost his sight in an accident when he was 25 years old. Today, he is 73. In this conversation, we talk about his life before the accident itself, and his life in the 48 years since becoming completely blind. Well, Jerry Young, thank you so much for being my friend for the last 33 years. You have been an inspiration to me and to so many people that you and I both know, and others that, of course, I don't know. And now I want you to be an inspiration to my podcast audience here on Kentucky Voices and Views. Let's start out with you talking about your life before the accident, from maybe age 18 on. I know you were in the Navy. I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And then lead up to what occurred that was this life-changing event when you were 25 years old. So you've graduated from high school, then what?
Well, actually, I did not graduate from high school. I was going to Valley High in Louisville, Kentucky, and I finished the 10th grade and turned 17 in June of 1956. And I decided I would go in the Navy and talked about it all summer. Well, not all summer, because my dad found out about it and he brought me out to the kitchen table and said, "I understand you want to go into service." I said, "Yeah, I'd like to go in the Air Force. I'm thinking about it." He said, "When you planning on going?" I said, "Well, I thought I'd wait until September until school started and go in then." He said, "No, you're not. You're not living off me all summer. So if you want to go in, we're going now." And so he took that was on Saturday. He took Monday off and took me down to the recruiter. I just so happened to get to the Navy recruiter first, and I was going to the Air Force, but I was so impressed by the Navy recruiter, what he had to say, that I signed up right then. And 2 weeks later, somewhere around 17th or 20th of July of 1956, I left for boot camp and went on my way to boot camp and went to Bainbridge, Maryland. And then from there went to, well, I had a temporary layover. And in 57, I guess it was, I went to service school in Great Lakes, Illinois. And I took up a machinist mate, which was running the main engines on the ship, and which is something I wanted to do because I like mechanical things. And I went to school there and graduated from that in the summer of 57 and went aboard ship and went to went around the world, went all over the Pacific, several places in the Pacific, Australia, Hong Kong, China, Midway, many of the islands in the Pacific, and came back to the States. By then I was getting close to 18 years old, and I completed my last 2 years in the Navy on a ship out in California training reserves. Was in the reserve training fleet, so we never did make any long trips overseas after that. We just trained reserves up and down the coast from Mexico to Alaska and over to Hawaii on a couple of occasions, but that's all I did after that. Then I got married when I was 18.
Let me ask you, you crossed the equator too.
Yeah.
When you were in the Navy, and I thought it was a fascinating story you told me decades ago about the ceremony that you went through on the ship when you crossed the equator. Would you touch on that?
Oh, I had a lot of fun. Those folks in the Navy who've not crossed the equator were called polywogs, and the people who'd gone across the equator were called shellbacks. And going across the equator is a great big ceremony, a big build up to it. On the morning that we crossed the equator, all the people who had not crossed the equator had to put on their clothes outside and backwards, so they could be identified by the shellbacks. And we went through all kinds of treatment. We had to get on the bow of the ship and bow down and so-called pray to Neptune Nix, who was the king of the sea, and they doused us down with fire hoses with seawater there. And then we had to go through the court of Neptune Rex, and we had to, we had to, a couple of different things we had to go through with, and they cut our hair off, just whacked our hair up, butchered it up terribly. You had to get your head shaved after that because it was such a mess. And the doctor said we all had some kind of epizootie or wild disease. He painted our face all up with Jensen Violet and methylate, made it purple and red, so everybody would know. Then you had to go through, the last thing was crawl through the chute into shellback land, and the chute was a canvas thing that they had filled up with garbage they'd saved out of the mess hall for about a week. And you had to crawl through that, and God, you're a royal mess when you come out of the other side of that. And then after that, had to go take a shower, change your clothes and take a shower, and they wouldn't let us have any hot water, and try to think about washing bacon grease off of you with cold water and stuff. So it was a mess, but it was a lot of fun. We had a great time. It was a lot of fun. And then fortunately, next time it would have been my time, although I didn't go across the equator except coming back. We didn't have any polywogs on ship when we came back, so I didn't get to go through the ceremony as a shellback, but I could have. But it was a lot of fun, and I have a lot of good memories of that. I've lost it, but one time I had my subpoena to Neptune Rex's court, and what I was charged with was trying to grow a mustache.
Well, you have now.
Oh, but I didn't then. And Lord, I was 25. Let's see, how old was I? I was 35 years old before I grew enough facial hair to have a mustache. You'd have to stand me in a certain position with the sun shining beside me to even be able to see the hair on my face up until I was past 30 years old. And that was what I was charged with, so it was one of the funny things that happened on the ship. But anyway, I came back and was in the training fleet, and then got married when I was 18 years old after I got back from over there, and was married a girl from California, and was married to her for 3 years, I guess, and she died in 1961. And I was about 22 years old then when she died. I married a girl from Brownsville, Kentucky at that time, and we were married till 68. But in 1964, 4 days after my 25th birthday, I was in an automobile accident, lost my sight, and I was ambitious, I guess you might say, or trying to provide well for my family. Being mechanically inclined, I wanted to be a machinist or a tool and die maker. And the company that I was working for at the time, American Saw and Tool Company, a branch of Vermont American, was offering an apprenticeship, tool and die apprenticeship. I applied for it, and because I had been in the service when I was 18 years old, they were going to let me have it because they said normally they wouldn't do it if I was past 18, but because of my military service, they were going to let me have it. I was going to school at night, working during the day, driving 75 miles a day round trip to work and back home. And
nope, where was this drive from, to and from?
I lived in Muldrow, Kentucky, out by Fort Knox, and I drove in 31W into Louisville and then drove back out there in the evening.
That Dixie Highway?
Yeah, Dixie Highway out of Louisville. And you can't burn the candle both ends no matter how old you are. And I went to sleep driving home to work on my daughter's fourth birthday, as a matter of fact. They were in the backyard with the party ready to go, just waiting for me to get home. And I was like 2 miles, 3 miles, something like that from the house, and went to sleep on Muldrow Hill and ran in the back of a trailer truck, put my lights out. And I spent the next 3 months, that was June the 12th, and I spent until sometime in early October, I guess, or how many months that is, in and out of the hospital, getting my face repaired and my teeth put back together as well as they could. And
I believe you have told me over the years that it was for lack of a Coke that you had the accident.
Well, not necessarily that specifically, but what I used to do when I was on this schedule, about halfway between Louisville and where I lived, there was a restaurant. I used to pull in there and get a big, large Coke with lots of ice in it. And I'd drive the rest of the way home, drink that Coke, and eat the ice and chew on the ice, and that kept me awake. Well, this day was my daughter's fourth birthday. I had stopped by a store, Walmart-type store, and bought a bunch of stuff for my daughter's birthday to take home for her party. And when I went past that restaurant, I looked at it, and I thought, I should get a Coke, but I don't feel very sleepy right now. I'm wide awake, and I'm excited about the party, so I just passed on it. Well, I did. I passed on it, and I fell asleep at the wheel. If I'd have got the Coke, I wouldn't have fallen asleep. But that's the way it goes.
I've kept that in mind many times on long drives that I have had over the years since you told me that. And anytime I thought I needed to stop at McDonald's and get that cup of coffee, I did it. And I appreciate you teaching me that.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. Well, of course, I don't know about how much the Coke had to do with me staying awake, but I know eating that ice helped a lot. Just chewing on the ice and all that could help me a lot, because I remember times feeling a little bit sleepy and chewing on that ice and perking me up and keeping me awake long enough to get home safely.
Just getting out of the car for a couple minutes was a huge help, I'm sure.
Well, see, I usually got home from school and work about midnight, got to bed and got up at somewhere like 4:45, 5:00 in the morning to head back to Louisville to work. And so I'd work and get off work 3:30. I think it was 3:30 we got off work, and then I'd go to classes and then head home. So,
well, take me back to that moment. So you're going down the highway home, just 2 or 3 miles away, and you fall asleep. So do you think your foot hits the accelerator then and you ram into the truck, or how did that occur?
It probably did. My foot probably just leaned, as it relaxed, probably just pushed the gas down farther, because they said the speedometer was jammed at 70. And I wasn't going that fast, because at the bottom of the hill there was a state barn where they kept equipment, and a cop hid behind that. You couldn't see that cop heading toward Muldrow until you got right there at the barn. By then it was too late. If you were speeding, he'd already nailed you. So I always slowed down, looked at my speedometer and slowed down to make sure I wasn't speeding. And that day I passed that barn doing about 55 miles an hour, and started up the hill, made a little curve to the left and started up the hill. And I noticed the trailer truck at the top of the hill. The hill was long and fairly steep, and trucks could not make it. They hit the bottom doing 60. At the top, they'd be doing 5 miles an hour, because they just had to gear down to get up the hill. And I noticed the truck up there, just noticed it, and that's all. Well, the next thing I knew, I opened my eyes, and I was probably one car length from the back of the truck.
So I thought that I remembered you saying that you did wake up just right before impact, and the last thing that you have seen that you saw was the back of that truck.
Right? Said Rooney. Rooney Truck Lines, and it was the back, last thing I saw the back of that truck said Rooney. And I just, when I saw I was going to hit, I said, well, here I go again. If I had been awake, you know, just a few seconds longer, I would have had presence of mind, jerked the wheel to the left and miss it, because the car was already drifting to the left. So the corner of the trailer got inside the doorpost on the left side of the car. So if I could have just jerked the wheel over, I could probably have missed it, mostly, if not completely, or not gotten hurt as bad as I did. But at any rate, I said, here we go again, and hit the truck. And I remember what the sound was like when it hit the truck. And that was the last thing I remember about that till a long time later. And I don't know how long it was, but quite a while later, I remember waking up and feeling around. I felt blood all down in front of me, and I couldn't see anything. And I felt the roof of the car all bent up and glass all over the place and everything. And one guy was saying, cut the battery cables, it's on fire. And I remember thinking that I got to get out of this car. I'm not going to burn in this car, because I thought he meant the car was on fire. But I said, I got to get out of this thing. The steering wheel was kind of mashed down in my lap, and the driver's door was partially open. And I just pulled up on the steering wheel until something broke loose and I could get my legs free, wrap my hands up, my arms over my head, and rolled out on the ground. Just rolled out on the ground. Then the next thing I remember, I was in the ambulance going to the hospital, and then the next thing I remember, I was in the operating room.
What did the accident do to you physically?
Broke the bones up my face and cut my right eye completely up. Cut it out. The glasses I had on broke and it cut my right eye up, and my left eye had an internal hemorrhage which destroyed it. But it broke all the bones in my face from my eyebrows down. Hmm. That's all. I got one little cut on my left arm. Took about 3 or 4 stitches for that. But other than that, I didn't have any other injuries.
So your face hit the steering wheel?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the best I could figure out, the steering wheel went across, right across my eyes, and one of the spokes went down the right side of my face and broke that side of my face and broke my lower jaw on that side. And the reason I think about it was I must have had my head bowed down a little bit when I hit it. The impact must have thrown me forward and had my head down, because the way it caught my nose and pulled everything down. The bones at the corner of each eye where my sideburns are was broken off. And all the bones across where my sinus cavities were, nose and palate and everything, palate was split and nose was mashed into my face and all that stuff. So the way it hit, it evidently caught and pulled the bones down. Mm-hmm. And so, and got my eyes too, because I had on a pair of sunglasses and it broke them all to pieces.
So now you have to recover. So what was recovery like?
First 10 days I was in and out. They didn't know whether I was going to live or not. And one of the doctors, the Army doctor there at the hospital, stayed, he said, by my bed as much as he possibly could for that first 10 days. He said, they usually know from looking at a person's eyes whether they have any brain damage. Well, I didn't have any eyes, and they couldn't tell that, and they wanted to be there. And he said, if I'd had a brain hemorrhage, it wouldn't have been anything he could do to save me. But he wanted to be there to try to prevent it as much as he could. So he was there by the bed for the first 10 days, and then they started pricking the bottom of my feet with needles and seeing what the response was, and that told them my brain was as good as it was before. I'm not going to say it was okay, but it was at least as good as it was before. And then it started, I remember during that first 10 days, and I don't know how long after, there were voices in and out. Some of them I knew, some of them I didn't know. A lot of people came to visit to see me, and you know, my sleeping was very erratic. I just slept whenever I felt like it, and it might have been day, it might have been night. But a lot of people came to see me, and I don't know who all they were, and still don't know, but then I knew who some of them were. But then after about, the first 2 or 3 weeks, things started settling down and getting some order to them. And I began to spend some time thinking about whether I was going to be able to see. My face was wrapped all up, my eyes were covered, and my face was all wrapped up. My teeth were wired together because my lower jaw was broken and my palate was split in two and broken up pretty badly, and so they had to stabilize it. And so they wired my lower jaw together to the right side of my mouth, just under my chin there, and that stabilized that. Then they wired the top teeth to the bottom to hold them all together and hold them in line as well as they could. And that's why I stayed for 12 weeks. But anyway, after that first 2 or 3 weeks, when things started having some order about them again, I began to think about life and liberty and pursuit of happiness, so to speak, what I was going to do. And first thing I decided I was going to be blind. This was it. This is the way life was going to be from now on. And I might as well get used to it, and I might as well start right now accepting it and figuring out what I'm going to do about it. A month or so after that, the doctors came in. One of the doctors came in and told me, he said, you know, I hate to tell you this, but I got to tell you, you're not going to ever be able to see again. I said, well, okay, I've already accepted that. And he said, if we could have gotten you to the hospital within 20 minutes after your accident, we might have been able to save the sight in your left eye, but you weren't here and we couldn't do that, so they didn't save it. And I started thinking about what life was going to be about and what I was going to do, and there were a lot of things went through my mind. One of the things was, all I knew about people who were blind was sitting on the street and selling pencils and shoestrings and playing guitars and harmonicas. I knew a little bit about the blind school in the East End of Louisville. Never been in it, but I'd been on the bus up that way and seen blind kids come in and out of there and all that, and I knew a little bit about it. And none of those things suited me. I tried to figure out what would suit my life and what would suit me. I knew I could go back home to my grandmother's house and stay there, and she'd take care of me and wait on me hand and foot, and I'd never have to worry about anything as long as I lived. But I didn't want to do that because that meant vegetating, and I just absolutely didn't want to do that. So finally, I had to decide what to do. And I finally decided, well, you just got to get up and put your feet back on the ground again and take another run at it. You got to keep on keeping on.
You're 25 years old.
Yeah. 25, I was about 3 months past my 25th birthday. And I said, I got to just keep on keeping on. I got to keep going at it. I've got a family to support. At that time, I had three children, little children. The oldest one was four. And I said, I got somebody has got to put the bread and bacon on the table for the family, and that's my responsibility because that's the way I was raised. It was my responsibility, so I had to get well and get up and get out of there and get back to it. And I began looking at things like that and trying to figure out and learning as much as I could learn. And psychiatrists, hospital psychiatrists come around and ask me one time what I thought about being blind. I told them, I said, I don't have time to think about that. I don't have time to be concerned about that. I've got a family. Somebody's got to support, and all I've got to think about now is how I'm going to get out of here, how I'm going to get well and get out of here and get back to work and what I'm going to do. Because, you see, at that time, I didn't realize the difficulties of not being able to see. In my mind, I could picture all the roads and places and all that kind of stuff I went. It was just hard to accept the fact that I wasn't going to be able to just do that again. It was really tough, and that was one of the hardest things for me to accept throughout this thing was the fact that I'm not going to be able to go back to the factory and work and earn a living for my family. I'm not going to be able to do that. And that was really tough. It took a long time to get used to that because the way I was raised was man takes care of his family.
Well, how did you get past that?
Well, I had, of course I had to take commodities and different things from the government and different welfare programs, and it really bothered me a lot. But then I got to thinking about it. I got Social Security disability, and I got to thinking about it, and I got to thinking, I paid into that stuff. That Social Security was originally an insurance policy that you paid into to insure against these kinds of things, and I paid into all those things. So it's not really welfare. It would have been had I not had a job, had I not served time in the military, had I not worked hard and went to work every day and paid my taxes, all that. It would have been welfare, but it's not because I paid into it. I worked for this, and it was an insurance that I paid into, and I deserve some of this stuff coming back. So that's the way I came to terms with it. I didn't see it as a handout. Because I had worked. I know of people who did never hit a day of work in their life, and they get all kinds of welfare, and I could not have done that. I couldn't live like that without working. Since I've been blind, all these years since I've been blind, I found something to do. For 34 years, I climbed towers and put up antennas, and I worked on cars. I don't do that much anymore, but I used to. I work on cars every day and earn all the money I could earn. I did everything I could do to make an honest buck. Because that was just my way of life. You worked and earned what you got and as much as you could, and you didn't have to worry about taking handouts from people. Because when I grew up in the world I lived in, you didn't take handouts, you didn't take charity. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. Some people said, "Where did your strength come from?" I don't have any idea. I do not know where it came from. I don't know what strength it is. All I know is I've had to think things through and be practical and rational about them and come to terms with them. And I've come to terms with a lot of different things. The hardest year of my recovery, so to speak, readjustment, because it took about 5 years, but the hardest year of my readjustment was about the middle year, about the third year. I went for blind rehab training early on in 66. I went for a guide dog at one point, and I did some things like that and didn't have too much to deal with on that level of welfare and that kind of stuff. But in 1966 or 67, somewhere along there, I hit a wall. And that wall came in the form of the feeling of impotence. I felt totally emasculated for that year. I felt like I had no power, whatever. I didn't have any strength, psychological, spiritual strength, or no power for that year. I did some nasty things to people during that year, trying to establish myself and trying to prove that I had some power. I'm not proud of them. Never have been proud of them. After that year, I got to looking back, and I totally regretted some of the things I did. And I apologized to a lot of people for the things I did, and I hope they understand. I hope they forgive me for it, but it was just part of living. But after at the end of that year, and I think time was the only thing that brought me through it. I had a chance to sit back and look at things rationally and see them from a different perspective, and the time got me through that. Well, then in the last couple of years of this readjustment, it went on from up until about 69. I started thinking about going to college and getting some education. I couldn't sell my mechanical skill. Nobody wanted to buy it because they didn't want me in a shop where I might get hurt or might cause something to happen to hurt somebody else. So they just wouldn't talk to me if I was going to do any mechanic where I had to do it on my own.
But you were trying to get people to employ you?
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. Government was one of the worst people. I worked at the Naval Ordnance Plant in Louisville before I lost my sight, and I knew there were several jobs in their bench jobs that I could have done and could have done them safely. And I went out there and applied for a job and sent all my paperwork in, and the administrator, the head man in that outfit out there, called me in, and he said to me, had I seen your application before it went in, I would not have let it go in. He said, I wouldn't let you be hired here. Well, the application, I got a letter back from the Civil Service Board or whoever evaluated those things, and I was denied. I sent them an appeal and never heard anything back from them ever.
Hmm. Hopefully things would be different today.
Huh?
Hopefully things would be different today.
Yeah,
for some
hopefully. But I couldn't get a job there, and then I went to different places. I went down to a place in Louisville, Auto Parts House in Louisville, and trained on how to rebuild starters and alternators and generators and stuff for cars, and they were supposed to set me up in a shop, and that was a joke. It was a clown act. It was a joke. Guy took me out to a little old building fairly close to my house. I was supposed to rent and set up a shop in there, and the building was just an old barn. It had holes in the walls big enough to throw a small dog through, and I was supposed to rent that place and run a shop in there in the winter. Summer wouldn't have been too bad. I guess I could have got by with it in summertime, but not in the winter. And one of the guys down there at the parts house who was training me, I caught him trying to put the screws to me. And I'm pretty outspoken, always have been. And when I told him, I knew what he was trying to do. He was doing things like parts, small parts that cost 2 or 3 cents a piece. Now, the state was supposed to provide those things for me to get set up, and after that first initial investment, I was on my own to make it. So he was going to charge me 25 and 30 cents a piece for these items that cost 3 or 4 cents. Mm. And I called his hand on it right in front of everybody. Boy, he got so mad at me. If he hadn't been there where people watched, he'd have probably crowned me with something. But that ended that because he was sorry for him to get real fat on it. And my argument was this: why buy me one of these things when it's and charge me 30 cents for it when you could buy five of them, because they're on 2 or 3 cents a piece, you could buy five of them, and that would be a better stock for me because I wouldn't have such a problem replacing stock mm-hmm. when I had so little stock to start out with. You know, you make one, then you got to wait till you sell it and get enough money to buy some more for the next one, where if you got five, you could make five and put them on the shelf. You'd have, and you sold one, you could start replenishing your stock and keep it ahead of the game. And so I was just, that blew up. That didn't work. So,
but so you're 25 years old. You have a 10th grade education.
Well,
I got
my GED in the Navy, and
didn't know that.
About a year and a half after I went to the Navy, I realized what a stupid mistake I'd made quitting high school, and I went to the educational officer on the ship and told him I wanted to do something about getting my education. He informed me about the GED, and I got that.
While you were in the Navy?
Yeah.
I did not know that. So now you have been through 5 tough years, and you decide that you want to go to college. How did that come about?
I just decided that after I couldn't get anybody to hire me to do mechanical work and stuff, maybe I need to get a little more education, brain power, maybe I can sell that. So I went to Indiana University. I wanted to start out a small place. I went to Indiana University Southeast Campus in Jeffersonville and told them I wanted to go and apply, and they let me go and put me on probation, of course, for the first 6 months. I didn't have to do anything special, take any special tests, because it had been over 10 years since I'd been out of school then. I was 30 and I quit school when I was 16, so it had been over 10 years and I'd been in the service and had my GED. So they said, okay, you can go ahead and start taking classes. And I took classes over there for 2 years. I think when I left there to come to University of Kentucky, I think I probably had a 2.8, 3 point, something like that, GPA. I don't know exactly, but somewhere around there. And I transferred. I was in business administration at the time I was over there, and I transferred to UK. They wouldn't accept it. I would have lost almost all my hours. So I had to change my major, and I changed it to sociology and got into the humanities and went on from there.
And got your master's, right?
Yeah.
And your master's is in what field?
Family studies.
Did you do anything with that?
I worked for the state for a year as a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And I mostly just do freelance stuff now, because there again, I applied for jobs and various and sundry different things happened that got in the way of that. One time I went to apply for a job as a drug counselor, and the state worker told me that I wasn't qualified because I needed 6 months on the job to be qualified for this job, so I was turned away. 3 months or 4 months later, after the job was already filled, she told me that she had not read far enough, that my master's degree would have sufficed for the 6 months on the job, and I could have gotten it, but by now somebody else already had it, and I went and talked with them several times over the years after that, and nothing seemed appropriate or came up, so I just decided, well, at some point in time, and I don't know when, I decided the best thing I can do is work for myself. And so I work for myself. I've got a garage at home, and like I said, I put up towers for 34 years and sold antennas and sold towers and antenna parts, radios and stuff.
This was for Citizens Band Radio back when that was a big deal, right?
Yeah, back in CB days, and worked on cars.
There have been articles, as you know, for our listeners, articles in the Lexington Herald newspaper from time to time with pictures of you on antennas, towers way up in the air, and it amazes people that you were doing that, that anybody could do that. And I know one of the things you've told me over the years is, since you can't see how far down it is to the ground, it really doesn't bother you.
Yeah, Parade Magazine did a thing on me at one time about working on cars and climbing towers. And what I tell people, this is true, people say they stand on the ground and look up at the clouds moving past the tower, makes it look like it's about to fall over, and they get scary. And it is true. When I get up there, I can't see how far away the ground is, so I'm just working. It's just a workplace, and it doesn't scare me.
And what you were doing was taking towers down.
Oh, I put them up.
Oh, you put them up.
Put them up and took them down and put antennas on top of them. I climbed up there and assembled antennas on top of them and put rotors on them and all that stuff, did all of it. And one of the rules that I had, which is my personality, was this: I would not leave anything on top of that tower that I wouldn't have on my own. In other words, I wouldn't do shoddy work. If it ain't good enough to be on my tower, it's not good enough to be on theirs. And so I did all the details. I stayed there and did the details and did everything exactly right. And I knew they weren't going to climb up there and look at it. I knew they weren't, for the most part, going to take a pair of binoculars and look at it to check and see what kind of work I did. But I had to have my own self-respect, my own pride, so I had to do it right.
And then you have the garage in on your property here in Lexington, and I've been in there a number of times, and it's a very, you know, it's a real garage where you have worked on people's cars for a few decades now, right? But with the change in with computers and all of that on cars, you are only able to work on cars that are built up to a certain date, I would think, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, yes, you're right about that. The older cars, because the situation is the newer cars have so much electronic equipment on it that you have to have special electronic equipment and computer and all that to analyze them. And I don't have the money to buy them. Not interested much anymore. I'm getting too old to be turning wrenches for anything other than just pleasure. And I still do a little bit of little work. For example, not too long ago, I did a friend. I sold a guy, let me back up, start the story. I bought a 71 Chevelle about 25 years ago and fixed it up and sold it. Guy burned it up and I rebuilt the motor in it for him. And he drove it for a few years and then he stored it. It stayed stored for a long time. Well, here about 2 or 3 months ago, the guy called me, said he was going to get it out of storage and wanted to bring it over to my house and wanted me to take the motor and transmission out of it and store it for him. I said, okay. So he brought it over to the house and I got thinking about it and talking to him. I said, that's dumb because you'll take this out and put it away. You'll pay somebody to store it, me or somebody else to store it for you for a time. 5 years from now, you'll want to get it out. You'll want to get rid of it. Nobody will want it. It's obsolete now, just about, but in 5 years, it's really going to be obsolete. Nobody will want it. You won't have to be able to do anything with it but junk it, and you will have spent a lot of more money on storing it just like you did this car. So the best thing to do is, why don't you just sell the car? Just sell the whole car. So he said, well, okay. He finally understood and agreed that I was right. So he said, okay, and I found the guy that I bought it from originally who wanted it back. And he said he wanted it back, and he wanted me to make it run, you know, tune it up and get the oil changed in and all that. And I did that and had to put another gas tank on it because it sat in storage 10 or 12 years, and gasoline sat in that long turns to varnish, and it messed everything up bad. So I didn't even want to take a chance on trying to pump that old gas through the car. So I just took it off, put a new gas tank on it for him, and he eventually drove it out, and drove it home.
And you do all that without being able to see at all. That's amazing. Sure. I know one time I was in your garage and I asked you if you could turn the lights on. And you had some funny comment about sighted people and their
well,
need for lights or something.
Me and the car club, I belong to Ancient Age Street Rod Club, and the car club and I got together and built a street rod out of my old truck. I bought an old 47 Ford truck back in 1977. And in 78, I guess it was. They started working on this truck, and for 5 years we worked every Wednesday night in my garage and built a street rod. Well, I did the mechanical stuff for the most part, and I'd get out there and work on stuff. I'd be in the garage working, and the guys come over to help. You know, a bunch of them, you know, anywhere from 10 or 15 of them, and they'd come over to help, and they'd come in the garage, and there I am, I'm there working up a storm, no lights on. They'd tell me, say, hey, you're going to have to turn the lights on for us handicapped folks. We can't work in the dark. So so I'd have to turn the lights on. It got to be kind of a running joke over there but about me not having the lights on. But the fact of the matter is I don't need any lights. And so why waste electricity?
Well, Jerry, I'd like to take the last 20 minutes of our conversation to talk about things that you would recommend, advice that you would give to someone who has suffered a life-changing reality of some type, and using your personal experience plus your education, what's the next step for a person, and what are maybe two or three steps after that? And also, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about communications and leadership training and your experiences with Toastmasters over the years.
We're going to do this like a cereal like they used to do back in the 50s, make it last for 6 months or a year.
We could come back and
to answer all those questions take a long time. But first of all, to address the generality of your first series of questions is this. It's got to be your attitude. You have to have the correct attitude. Nobody owes you anything. You know, it's got to be your attitude. And that's what I've learned over the years, and I guess I learned it real early, back even by the end of the 5-year period, you get more done by looking out than you do by looking in. You know, people will help you as long as you're trying to help yourself, but if you run around with your hand stuck out all the time, people get tired of helping. Of course, I don't know if that's really true anymore very much, but that's the way I feel about it. So if you're in there trying to do your own stuff and do it as best you can, and you need help, there'll be people to help you. So look outward, have a positive attitude about life and about what's going on around you, and look outward, and you'll find that all the things you crave, all the attention you crave, all the respect you crave, if you crave that kind of stuff, and all that will come to you if you're not looking inward. If you're busy looking inward, you'll never get that stuff. But you forget about you and where you are in your position, and think about helping others, and think about doing what you can for others in whatever capacity you can. You'll find out that when it's all said and done, you'll have a lot of respect. The people have a lot of respect for you. And that's the way I experience life, the way it's been for me, and the way I feel about it. I like the thing that somebody told me one time. They said, point your finger. And I pointed my finger at somebody, and they said, when you point your finger out, you got three looking back at you. So don't be condemning of others. Try to help others and have the right attitude about it, because those things that you want will come to you if you don't pay attention to them. In my life, I've had most of the things that I want because of two things. First of all, I'm looking outward, trying to help other people. Second of all, I just wait for God to give them to me. I don't put any time on them. I don't say I got to have this by next Thursday or something like that. I just wait. I just put it out there, tell God that's what I want, and wait. And if the time is right, then it'll come to me, and things have. Things have always come to me. Things that I want have come to me. People have given me stuff. It's come to me out of the blue. And it's just because I think it's because I focus on other people. I don't care about necessarily about getting in the limelight. I've been in the limelight. It's fun. It's interesting. But I don't need to be there all the time. I need to, speaking of leadership, that's one of the biggest things about leadership a person can learn. You put others in front. Give them an opportunity to learn. Put others in front. That's what a good leader does. Good leader puts somebody else in front and steps aside and let them do it, and guides them if they need guidance, and help them when they need it, but otherwise stay out of their way and let them learn.
And you have practical experience with leadership, I know, because you have been the leader of the amateur radio club in Central Kentucky, as well as a district governor for Toastmasters International. Tell us a little bit about your leadership experience with the Amateur Radio Club.
Well, I guess I used the things that I learned in Toastmasters through that, but when I got in the Amateur Radio Club, I just decided that we had to run things by order. You have to get everybody, has to have an opportunity to have their say. That's important. Everybody, no matter who they are or what they have to say or what they think, you got to give them an opportunity to have their say. They're part of the group, they're paying their dues, and they have a right to have their turn. And so that was my philosophy. And I told the guys when I first was elected president of the Bluegrass Amateur Radio Society, I told them, I said, it doesn't make any difference if you've been in this club 50 years or 50 minutes. We're all equals. We're all brothers in this hobby, and we're all equals. And don't be looking down your nose at somebody new that just come in because you've been in here for 50 years. Remember, at one time, you were new, and you needed help, so help these guys. Don't be looking down your nose at them, and everybody gets an opportunity. And I used parliamentary procedure to run the meetings and make sure everybody had an opportunity to hear, have their time to say what they had to say, and we all listened to them and respected them for saying it. I didn't always agree with what they had to say, but they had a right to say it. They had a right to be heard. And so, and I respectfully disagreed with them sometimes, and other times when they had a good idea, I gave them their dues. I gave them their accolades when they had a good idea. So the best way to be a good leader, and I tell people this, is delegate and disappear. You delegate responsibilities to people that you think can do them, that have the potential to do them or the ability to do them, then you get out of the way. You don't micromanage. When you micromanage people, you destroy their self-esteem and their self-confidence. You check with them from time to time to see that things are going the way they should be going, and see that they're doing okay and they don't need any help. But you let them do it. And when it's all said and done, they'll be good leaders, and they'll know how to do things because they've done it hands-on. And if you're always looking over their shoulder, micromanaging, pretty soon people get thinking, well, I can't do this. I might as well get out of here because he's always looking over my shoulder. So you just get back and let him go. I learned the hard way back about that. I was a co-chair in the Kentucky Welfare Association one time back in 1974. And I delegated some responsibility to some folks. And this one person, I kept trying to check with them, see how they were going, see if everything was going okay, and couldn't get any response. And I got nervous about it. So toward the deadline, I jumped in there and did some things, got somebody else to help me do some things. Well, the person that I had delegated that to was doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing, and they were right on target. Problem was, I didn't know, and they didn't let me know. But nevertheless, they were doing it. And when we had our final meeting lining things up, I got chewed out pretty royally and told that I should not have done that. And I realized that I shouldn't have, even though that person should have been in contact with me more often than they were. I still was wrong. And so I learned my lesson. You don't jump in on people like that. You check with them and trust that they're going to do it right. And if they don't do it right every time, so what? You know, and there are other times, and there are ways to recover from things. So you build your people, you build a confidence in your people by showing that you have confidence in them.
That was probably before your Toastmasters experience.
No, I was a Toastmaster at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about Toastmasters and how you first heard about it, why you got in it, what it was like when you first got in it, and what it's meant to you.
Back in, I think it was March of 1967, I think, is when I joined or got in. Sometime in 67, I was at home, and friend Charlie Myers came over and said, "You want to go to Toastmasters?" And I said, "I don't even know what that is." He said, "Well, come on, get your suit on and a tie, and let's go. I'll show you." I said, "All right," and I wanted to get out of the house anyway. And I went to Toastmasters, and I sat through the first meeting, and back then you visited two or three times before you applied. And each meeting I went to, I saw the value of what was going on and the learning experience and what was going on. I was still a high school dropout at that time. I had not been to college yet. But I went to it, and I decided to join. And one of the reasons I decided to join is because my wife and I had a fight shortly before, well, I guess the day before Charlie Myers came over. I was on the phone talking with some business person trying to act like I had some education. And we had been having words, and I got off the phone. She said, "You should listen to yourself putting on airs." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "You get on that phone and try to talk like you got some education and some smarts, and you put on airs. Everybody knows you're stupid." And, well, that hurt my feelings. But I got thinking, well, I guess she's right, because she finished high school and I didn't, so maybe she's right. So I went and joined Toastmasters, and when I saw what they could do and what I needed, I joined and stayed in. I've been in Toastmasters ever since. And one of the values of it is Toastmasters will help build your self-confidence and self-esteem in a hurry. We don't criticize people, and we don't put people down. We use the sandwich technique to evaluate each other, and that is, you give positive feedback, helpful suggestion, not criticism, helpful suggestion in the middle, and then positive feedback in the end. And you leave people on a high note, feeling positive about what they did, and that's what helped me help build my self-esteem and get me back in the game. And then I went to college. That was a big part of the reason I went to college. It gave me confidence to go to college because of Toastmasters. Once I got in college, I found out that the things that I had been learning in Toastmasters about organizing my speech and my thoughts and writing stuff, I couldn't even write an essay before I joined Toastmasters. All that experience and training on how to organize and how to choose topics and how to do things helped me tremendously in college, because it helped me get my thoughts together and helped me organize them, helped me write the papers I had to write and do the things I had to do. And so it was a big help, a tremendous help in Toastmasters, especially when I got in the master's program. In the master's programs, we had to make a lot of presentations. Well, it was right up my alley, because I'd been in Toastmasters for a long time by that time, and the ability and the skills that I had learned in Toastmasters by giving presentations helped a lot in college. So Toastmasters went a long way to help me be successful in college.
Some of our listeners might not know what Toastmasters is. Would you tell us?
Oh, yeah, good. Well, Toastmasters is a worldwide organization that's dedicated to the development of your communication, leadership, management, and public speaking skills. Now, when I was district governor, I did an unofficial poll, and I found out that less than 0.1% of the people in Toastmasters want to be professional public speakers. But 100% of those people all want to be better communicators at work and at home and in different places. And that's what we teach you to do, is teach you to be a better listener and a better communicator, and teach you to get along better with people. We teach you tact and diplomacy, help you learn how to do things tactfully and diplomatically when you have to, and communicate in such a fashion that you can be understood. So that's one of the values. Everybody should be in Toastmasters for a period of time, no matter who you are, no matter how good you are or how good you think you are. Everybody should be in Toastmasters. And I say Toastmasters is for everybody, but everybody's not for Toastmasters, but everybody should give it a try. And my favorite quotation about Toastmasters comes from Helen Blanchard, one of our international presidents, who said, "If you get out of Toastmasters, all you can get out of Toastmasters. You will never get out of Toastmasters." I've been in it 45 years. I never go to a meeting without learning something. I never go to a meeting without getting some good feedback from somebody in the meeting that helped me learn and grow and helped me be a more polished communicator.
And you regularly attend 5 clubs in the Lexington, Central Kentucky area, too, I think.
Yeah.
5 clubs, that's one. Now, besides Toastmasters and the Amateur Radio Society and the Car Club, you're very involved with the storytelling community here in Central Kentucky as well. Would you speak to that?
Yes, I just recently joined the Wandering Storytellers, part of the Kentucky Storytelling Association. That's a wonderful organization. There's a lot of fun, but the beauty in storytelling is that you're passing your culture and your heritage on to the next generation. It's fun to tell little kids stories about things that happened back when I was a kid, and they're just amazed at some of those things. And there again, in storytelling, you learn how to organize stories and make up stories and tell them. You learn how to be dramatic in telling your stories and be expressive and all that. And Kentucky Storytelling Association is all across the state. I think we have 4 quadrants in the state, and each quadrant is divided up throughout the state, but each quadrant has a director, and we have people in there. And we have a storytelling event on the last Monday night of the month at the main library downtown. It's 7 to 9 o'clock, and everybody's invited to come, and we have open mic. If you all have a story that you want to tell, all you got to do is raise your hand, and you can get up there and tell your story. As long as it's a clean story, and you can tell it in good taste, and you can tell any kind of story you want. That's one of the things about Toastmasters that parallels this is, in Toastmasters, you can speak about anything you want. We don't tell you what to talk about. We just give you instructions on how to present your material, but you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. And that's the fun of storytelling. You hear funny stories, you hear all kinds of stories, and I recommend it to everybody. And we even have a children's division in our KSA. It has a children's division, so little kids, I don't know what the age limit on, maybe 8 years old is the minimum age, but little kids can get in it. I know a few kids that are about 11 years old are dynamite storytellers. Man, they can tell some stories that put me to shame. and they're a lot of fun to listen to, and you cannot believe how imaginative and creative these kids are. They're just wonderful little kids. So,
as you and I talked about a week or so ago, I'll be working with you to produce some CDs of some of your storytelling, and that will be on the World of Storytelling Live 365 broadcast that Buck Creasy does. So we'll have some fun with that. And early in our conversation, Jerry, you mentioned that maybe we should serialize this, and I think you're absolutely right. There's so much more that I would like to talk with you about and have on a podcast of Kentucky Voices and Views in the future. we'll close this show for now with you saying anything that you would like to say. Any, as we say in Toastmasters, is there anything else for the benefit of the club? Is there anything else for the benefit of our listeners that you would like to talk about in a couple moments?
Something I'd like to address the next time we get together is a pet peeve I have, and that is referring to people, handicapped people, as disabled. I know the American Disability Act, and that is very politically correct to call people disabled, but I'm very much opposed to that for this reason. Why focus on that which you cannot do? Focus on the things you can do. I can't drive. I need somebody to help me drive. I can't read printed material. I need somebody to help me read printed material. Beyond that, I can do just about anything I want to do and have done it. So let's not focus on that which you can't do. Let's focus on that which you can do. If you're handicapped, you need a little help to level the playing field, but you're certainly not unable to do anything.
Well, thank you for that. And what I would like to do for in a future program is for you to come up with a list of advice topics to give people to assist blind people, or so what is the correct word? Not disabled, but what would the correct
word?
Handicapped. So, you've taught me a number of things over the years about how to approach you, you know, that you want to hold my elbow rather than me holding yours, that it's a good idea for me not to walk you into a newspaper machine like I did one time a few years ago.
Or a fire hydrant,
yeah. So we'll do a show in the future about that type of advice that you have for people, along with tools that you would recommend, or associations, what the community has to support people that are handicapped. Jerry, thank you very much for this last 50 to 60 minutes, and we will talk again.
Say, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm honored.
Thank you.
This podcast is proud to be part of the Blueberry Network. That's blueberry with no E's.com.